All right, ladies and gentlemen, around the Delaware Valley, welcome to the Pain and Wellness Hour with Sonny Banks. We're sponsored by Tony Shore and Pinnacle Medical Plus. We've got a fantastic show today. Sonny, how are you?
I'm doing well, Joe, though I understand that you're a little bit under the weather.
A little bit. Got a little cold and a little beat up. I probably got to get a little bit more sleep, but no fever, so all good. And I appreciate the accommodations. Normally, we're face-to-face. Nonetheless, we're going to have a fantastic show, no question about it. If you would, Sonny, introduce our guest.
Absolutely. Attorney Ricky Palladino was back with us today. Ricky is no stranger to the show. He's appeared several times, and we asked him back today because he's always provided our listeners with a lot of important information about immigration law. Ricky Palladino is one of the founding partners of the SIP, that's SIP law firm, otherwise known as Solo, Isbell, and Palladino. The firm has offices in Center City, Philadelphia, Media, Pennsylvania, and South Jersey. Ricky Palladino and the SIP firm focus their practice on all aspects of immigration law, including deportation defense, I-9 compliance, visa issues, etc. Ricky Palladino also does some criminal work as well as some personal injury cases. But again, the focus of the firm is immigration issues, and no firm resolves those issues better than the SIP law firm. Ricky, if you would, please tell our listeners again about yourself and about the importance of your law firm.
Sure. Sonny, it's good to be with you. Joe, good to be with you as well. thank you for the introduction. And yes, so my firm focuses primarily on immigration and nationality law. It's a fascinating practice where we get to help individuals from all over the world in a variety of different legal issues. We represent people that are going through the removal or deportation process. We represent individuals that are seeking political asylum or refugee status in the United States. We represent individuals seeking what's called family reunification. That can be a U.S. citizen filing for a spouse or child or sibling. And we also, there's a corporate element to our practice where we represent companies, large and small, that are seeking to bring foreign workers into the United States, both on a permanent and a temporary basis. So we are devoted towards helping people from all over the world recognize their dream of living and working in the United States and eventually becoming U.S. citizens. And although our work is challenging, we certainly do love what we do and enjoy it every day. I should say that my firm has changed. The firm is now called Palladino, Isbell, and Casaza, and that was something that came about at the end of 2020, so we're a relatively new firm. Still have offices in Philadelphia. That's our main office, 1528 Walnut, and also an office in Media, PA, doing the same thing that the former firm did and hoping to do it better and to continue to get better.
COVID substantially affected your immigration practice?
So it did initially, Sonny. Just like anything else, when everything was shut down, we had a number of hearings and government interviews that were canceled and delayed. But right now, if anything, COVID has made us busier. And I think the reason for that is that the immigration process, and when you deal with immigration, you deal with the federal government. It's become so backlogged and so complicated that individuals realize that although they may have the skill to figure out how to do a case on their own, that they'd much rather be guided by a professional, especially as it relates to the delays. And sometimes we are able to help people navigate around them, and many times we're not. But COVID has made us busier from that standpoint because there's really no such thing as an easy immigration case anymore.
And how about the change in administration? Has that been good or bad for your practice?
Yeah, so the change in administration has been, it's been a drastic change in the sense that, you know, the last time that the three of us were together, I believe, was in 2019. And just to put this into perspective for you, in 2019, my firm at any given time had anywhere between 30 or 40 individuals that were detained. And that number changed every week as people got deported and there was new people that were arrested and detained. Contrast that with now, we only have probably at any given time two or three people that are detained. Yeah. And that's a big change from the administration. The Trump administration was obviously focused on removal and trying to increase the numbers of people being deported from the United States. We're not seeing that as much from the Biden administration. But we're also not seeing the changes that we thought we would see under the Biden administration. And I think Congress is partially to blame for that. What was interesting for our practice is, you know, the very first day after President Biden was inaugurated, he made a speech and said that immigration reform was his main objective in his right. presidency. And obviously that gained a lot of news coverage, and our phone was ringing off the hook. You know, and here we are almost a year later, and there has been no immigration reform. We've seen, you know, the government change their priorities in terms of who they're going to go after and who they're going to investigate and prosecute. But there hasn't been a pathway to legalization for people the way that we thought that there was going to be. And if that happens, that will change our practice drastically.
Is your firm involved in any of the litigation involving the separation of immigrant families from, you know, their children and unlawfully detaining them?
Sure. So we're not involved in the litigation that's going on seeking remuneration from the U.S. government for the errors that were made. With that said, we do represent individuals who did come in through the border, were separated from their families, and ultimately reunited. So we see it from that angle, but aren't representing individuals who are bringing claims against the U.S. government.
Joe?
Ricky, did you, in your entire life and your career, ever think immigration would be as hot button issue as it's been over the last 8 years?
You know, I never thought so, Joe. When I started to do this, you know, I started my career in immigration working for the Immigration and Naturalization Service. It was called the INS. And I started there in the year 2000, and I was actually there working there when September 11th happened. The INS office in Philadelphia was located at 1600 Cowell Hill Street. And obviously, immigration was a hot topic at that point after September 11th, in part because I think it was three of the individuals that were in charge of, you know, manning the plane to fly it into the World Trade Center were individuals that were here with expired student visas.
Right.
So immigration was big time in the news then, and it actually resulted in that agency, the INS, being dismantled for the Department of Homeland Security that still exists. But even in those days when immigration was, you know, a very charged and political issue, it was nothing like it became during the Trump administration from 2016 to 2020. And there's a variety of different reasons for that. But prior to 2016, I never envisioned that we would be as busy as we had become, and never envisioned that it would be as, you know, politically charged in such a hot topic that it became.
That's exactly right. It's a political football like there's no tomorrow. I mean, you
that's
talk
true, Jeff.
And what ends up happening, I think, is that the American people, they obviously pick sides. But I don't know how accurate all the information and news is. And I say that because you hear one from one side and something completely different from the other side. Talk about this. I don't know if it's real or if it's not, but at one point they're talking about, you know, $450,000 going to every undocumented coming over from, you know, coming across in the, you know, over the wall, you know, from Mexico. Is that real? Or, I mean, what is that?
Yeah. So my understanding is that it's not real. You know, so I can't speak specifically on that because, like you, Joe, I've been confused by it as well.
Right.
So I'm a member of an organization based out of Washington, D.C. called the American Immigration Lawyers Association, or AILA for short. And part of what AILA does is, you know, publish material saying this is fact, this is fiction as it relates to immigration. You know, for years we would get calls from people, or I would be asked the question on radio or television, you know, about people that are not lawful permanent residents or U.S. citizens getting benefits from the U.S. government, whether it be welfare, food stamps, and the reality of the situation. And the answer to that is that they can't get those benefits in most circumstances. So, you know, the narrative that they're here, you know, violating and taking advantage of our social systems is just not true. And I believe that's the case also for this kind of idea that undocumented individuals would get this lump sum of money. I haven't seen anything published by the American Immigration Lawyers Association on this topic, but people that I do trust that are in the know have, you know, basically said that it's fake news. And that makes a lot of sense to me because it just doesn't make any sense to do it that way. I didn't understand when I first heard that what the rationale would be. But it seems to me to be very similar to what people were saying before about, you know, immigrants coming and taking benefits from our government, that it's just not true. And it's something that's become sensationalized, likely for political reasons.
But isn't the argument that a lot of immigrants are being taken advantage of and being sold, you know, Social Security numbers that aren't theirs and whatnot, to allow them to apply for government benefits?
Yeah, so, and that happens a lot, right? So individuals come to the United States and they're desperate for work, and it's such a complicated system that it's hard to get a legitimate Social Security number. So they buy fake Social Security numbers, which really come in two flavors. Sometimes it's just a card with a number that's made up, and other times it belongs to someone else. Perhaps it's someone that's deceased or someone doesn't know that their identity is being taken. And these individuals will work with those Social Security numbers, many for years, if not decades, and then get to a point where they want to reap the benefits of the Social Security system that they paid into, right through their payroll tax, and are unable to do so. The U.S. government's position on that generally is, well, we're not going to give you a benefit if you obtained it by fraud.
Right.
But back to your point, Sonny, yes, there's a lot of people, groups that have advocated for these immigrants because they did pay into it, albeit by fraud, that there should be some remuneration to them from the system that they paid into.
Yeah, it only seems fair.
Right.
And it seems to me like in a lot of ways, all this political jargon, really the individuals, now don't get me wrong, it's very difficult to get past Americans given, you know, people who have come into the country illegally. And so you're going to have a certain element of Americans who are absolutely, there's literally nothing you can say to them. However, at the same time, it seems to me like this is a political football like that we all understand that we use to go back and forth on which political candidates we're going to elect. But the big losers in that situation are the undocumented or even those trying to come over here legally, because it creates such a it puts a cloud out there that in some sense it's just the undocumented and those trying to get over, they take the brunt of it. Right now, coming to the United States and the American dream is not what it was just a few years ago. And do you think they take the brunt of it? And a lot of them, the Americans just don't really understand what the situations are?
Yeah, I think when you look at U.S. immigration law, what's fascinating about it is I think everyone's mind goes to how the law applies to people that come here, whether legally or illegally, and want to live here, right? So the law obviously applies differently to people that come with visas or that come with green cards than it does with people that, you know, cross the border. But there's also an aspect of the law that's rarely talked about, and that is that immigration law can bring sanctions against employers who employ individuals that are here unlawfully. And Joe, your question was, do these people that come across the border take the brunt of it? The answer is yes, they do. Because, you know, what's fascinating is I've 20 years I've been doing this, I've still never met an immigrant that didn't have a job. Never.
Right.
Every person that comes in to see me has a job.
Interesting.
So what that means is these people that are working essentially are being hired unlawfully. And one could make an argument that although I truly believe the vast majority of people that are coming here are coming here, especially from Guatemala, El Salvador, and Honduras, are coming here to flee persecution because the gangs are more powerful than the police where they're from. But there's definitely people that are coming here as economic refugees, people that are just coming because they want a better life, right? They can get better jobs here. And the reality of the situation is those jobs are available to them.
And they're being marketed to them. Is that true? Like they're being enticed by some of these corporations.
Totally. And not so much corporations as much as it is kind of the small, you know, landscape company or, you know, where there's manual labor, mushroom company, you know, farms, those types of things, where if we wanted to really cut down on the individuals that are coming here, we could send a clear message that there's not jobs for them. And again, it's not going to cut down on everyone, but it's going to significantly lower the amount of people that are coming here. And the way that you do that is by taking all of the resources that you have to enforce the immigration law through an agent, through part of the Homeland Security, which is called ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement, and you have that enforcement go towards employers. Well, if employers know that they're going to be fined and their name's going to be in the newspaper for hiring immigrants illegally, then they're no longer going to do it, which means that the jobs aren't going to be there, which means there's going to be less people coming here.
Unfortunately, ICE's focus is just the opposite. They're focused more on finding individuals who are here illegally as opposed to going against the employers who hire immigrants.
That's absolutely correct. And during the Trump administration, we did see more employer enforcement than we ever did before. But it pales in comparison to the enforcement that's done on individuals. And I don't have the numbers, but if I were to guess, I would say of the overall enforcement budget, about 1% of it goes towards enforcement on employers.
And are the penalties against employers who hire illegal immigrants substantial?
Yeah, they can be. There was probably the most notable story of the past few years, which happened, I believe in 2018, was the company Ashplund. And it was reported by the Philadelphia Inquirer.
Tree company, right?
Tree company, yeah. So what I understand and just understand of it, what the public record was that the U.S. government came in. They did enforcement. They fined them. And there's a range of fines that you can get per violation. And they gave them a reasonable fine that was negotiated. And then after they paid the fine, the government went back to investigate to see if they – you know, to clean their act up.
Right.
And when they realized that they continued to repeat the same mistakes or the same, broke the law again, then the fines became substantial. And if my memory serves me correct, I believe the fines were over $1 million.
Wow.
I mean, to me, that's, you would think that the agencies would go against, you know, would target these predatory employers because they have the money. I mean, the fact is, you want to find somebody who's enticing people to come over. And Sonny, that often when that's the case, there's all, you know, when you say predatory employers, they're often also not the safest employer. So, you know, a lot of times you hear these nightmare stories where somebody, and I'm going to take a shot at this, Ricky, but somebody probably, they probably market to new employers, new employees, through the workers they have. You got a buddy over, you know, in so-and-so, well, bring them over here, we'll put them to work. And so it's not like they need to do some big, long, and big employment campaign. But, you have some of these individuals are not just being predatory in that manner and then probably paying them, you know, slave labor, number one. But number two, Sonny, some of these working conditions can't be the greatest. They probably know that they can't do anything about it.
Yeah, I mean, we see it all the time in the workers' compensation arena, you know, where, you know, these folks get seriously hurt because the conditions are so poor, and then they're, told by their employer that they're not covered for workers' compensation, and if they do try and, you know, pursue or enforce a claim, then they'll be deported, and they'll lose their job.
I mean, to me, that's every bit. So, Ricky, have you ever come across a situation that's been so egregious that you were able to report the employer for taking advantage of individuals and putting them in hard situations? Or is that something that, you leave to the authorities?
Yeah, so, we encounter those situations very frequently. And the law actually has a special visa that is set up for individuals that basically are taken advantage of and that cooperate with law enforcement. So when that case comes in, Joe, we encourage our clients to work together with the Department of Homeland Security in reporting these individuals, because very often it's not just one person that's being taken advantage of, it's many of them. And the benefit that the immigrant gets is something that's called a T visa. And a T visa is for individuals that are victims of trafficking. And I realize in saying that that you may go, wait a minute, there's not trafficking here. Well, there can be when someone's brought here under false pretenses, they're made to work on the promise of being paid, and then they're not paid, you know, what they're promised. So the trafficking definition under federal law is very vague, and allows us to make arguments in that sense. So back to your question, yeah, this is something that we see frequently, and it's very sad. And the reality of the situation, to go back to what Sonny said, is that very often employers will just say, hey, if you report me, I'm going to get you deported. And to someone that's only been in the United States for a year or two, you know, they believe that to be a fact. But the reality is that employers don't have the ability to deport someone. As a matter of fact, no U.S. citizen has that ability to do so. What they would have to do is they would have to report the person to Immigration and Customs Enforcement, but a lot of the time they don't do that because they know that their hands are dirty as well, and they don't want the federal government snooping in on what they're doing to these individuals.
Well, it's interesting so they should say that, because I, you know, when you said that, I think I came up with something here, Ricky, that could turn the whole system around right now. I hope everybody's listening, Sonny.
Go for it.
You think I could do something that momentous? Why not require somebody who's reporting somebody to also report and establish who they are in order for the government to be able to accept the actual the report, so that because I agree with you that a lot of people don't want to make that report because that could come back to bite them in the butt. But at the same time. They would have to report themselves as well.
Right.
Yeah. So if you go to the ICE website or the Department of Homeland Security website, what you'll see in the top right corner is a tip line, a 1-800 number where you can report people, Joe, who are here unlawfully, or employers that are violating federal law. And, you know, in talking with some of the ICE agents that monitor and get that information, you're absolutely right that the people that call and provide their information, they're more likely to get have an investigation take place because it's more authentic, right? It's more believable when the person leaves their information as opposed to just someone leaving a tip saying, hey, there's a guy, Jose, who lives at this address who's illegal.
Right.
But, you know, again, going back to how the world has changed, especially the political world, you know, that is something that for years and years and years, people would ask, hey, if I call and report someone, do you think the Immigration Service will take action against them? Or if I report an employer, whatever it was. And for years, I would say, you know, you can certainly do that, but I doubt that it will happen. Well, from 2016 to 2020, you know, people that were calling and making those reports were seeing, you know, pretty fast results. And, you know, we don't know now how the current administration will respond to those types of things, especially since this administration has come in the middle of the pandemic and things haven't gotten back to normal yet. But I like your idea, Joe, and I think it's already in place in that if you do give information about yourself and make yourself available to answer questions, it's more likely that you're going to get a response from the federal government.
Ricky, the flip side of all this is that your firm is also involved in making it possible for highly skilled immigrants to come to this country to work for corporations.
Sure.
and other businesses, correct?
Yep. Yeah.
And tell us about that. What's involved in that?
Yeah, so probably the bread and butter work visa is something that's called an H-1B visa. And an H-1B visa is for individuals that are coming to the United States to work temporarily for jobs that are what's called a specialty occupation, a job that requires a bachelor's degree.
Such as
engineering, such as marketing, such as computer science. And if you look, each year the U.S. government publishes the, you know, top employers that sponsor individuals for H-1B visas, and it's Facebook, it's Google, it's Amazon. And if you think about it, and most of them are computer and tech jobs, Sonny, and if you think about it, you know, the coding that's done to expand Amazon's footprint in India, or in Bangladesh is done by someone who understands that language, right? And understands the way that the systems are set up there. So getting this foreign labor is very important. The problem with it, and this is going to sound crazy, but sometimes fact is stranger than fiction, is that there's a statutory limit on the amount of H-1B visas that the U.S. government can issue each year. And it's about 60,000. And because there's significantly more than 60,000 petitions that are filed each year, the government actually utilizes a lottery system to determine who's even eligible to have their H-1B petition adjudicated.
And who sets the limit? The government?
It's set by Congress. Yeah, it's in the statute. And there's been talk and request to increase that amount. But then it doesn't get anywhere because of the politically charged issue, right? So on the one hand, you know, companies like Google, like Facebook, American companies are saying, look, you know, we're publicly traded companies. We will continue to grow if we get this talent coming from all over the world, right? This benefits Americans. It's going to create jobs in the United States and probably going to benefit just about everyone's 401k or their stock portfolio. On the other side is individuals saying, well, wait a minute. These are good, high-paying jobs, right, with really good companies. This should go to U.S. citizens who are graduates of these universities and colleges and not to foreigners. And then the counterargument to that again is, well, if there were enough Americans to take these jobs, we wouldn't need to go and sponsor individuals.
Right.
There's just not enough Americans to take them. And if there are Americans, they lack the cultural background or they lack the language skills to really help us expand.
You said several times that companies sponsor individuals who apply for H-1 visas. What does that mean?
So a sponsorship means that they first and foremost have to deal with the U.S. Department of Labor, and they have to prove to the U.S. Department of Labor that they're going to treat this person the same way they would an American worker. And the way that that's done is by getting something called a prevailing wage. So the U.S. government will say, okay, if you want to hire this person in New York City, this is the wage for a software engineer position. So the employer, first and foremost, has to sign a contract, essentially. It's called a labor condition application with the Department of Labor in order to proceed and then going through the visa sponsorship process. The visa sponsorship process now involves, once you get past the Department of Labor, involves the Department of Homeland Security, an agency called USCIS, where you have to prove to them, assuming that you won the lottery, that the job is indeed a specialty occupation. And that sometimes becomes the fight, right? Mm-hmm. Sometimes the U.S. government comes back and says, well, we don't think that this job, the person needs a bachelor's degree in a specific field. We think it could be done by anyone. So, for example, if it was a business that wanted to hire an operations manager, you know, very often the U.S. government will say, well, you know, you don't need a business degree to be an operations manager. You might need just a general bachelor's degree. And in order to qualify for an H-1B, it has to be in a specific field. Sometimes they issue requests that I find to be crazy. For example, I remember one for an engineer who worked for a company that was in charge of building bridges, smaller bridges. And they came back to us and said, we don't think that this job requires a specialty occupation. Now, I don't know about you, but I certainly don't want to be driving on a bridge
that's
done by someone without a bachelor's degree in this specific, you know, field of engineering.
Sure.
So, you know, the problem with that sponsorship process is that, you know, we're dealing very often with federal bureaucrats, federal agents, who we can never get on the phone. It's all done by phone, or it's all done by paper. And, you know, these cases very rarely get judicially reviewed. So very often you're dealing with an agency that has political pressure to, you know, deny the number of visas that are issued, and you get ridiculous results that comes out of it.
Does the sponsoring company pay for the visa application?
Yeah, so that's a good point. When we say sponsoring someone, the law requires that organization to pay basically all of the government fees, which can be between $2,000 and $3,000, and to pay the attorney fees. Other than there's an exception to that rule. If the U.S. government comes back and says, hey, this job, you have to pay the person $50,000 a year, and they're paying $60,000, then the foreign national can pay the attorney fees because they're already making more than what they're supposed to. But in the vast majority of these cases, the employer is fronting everything. And that's the argument from the employer, which is, don't you think we would hire a U.S. citizen if we could? I mean, it would save us a lot of money.
Sure.
And it would save us a lot of heart, you know, headache and heartache in going through this, you know, somewhat ridiculous process.
Yeah.
And one more question, Joe.
Go ahead.
While we're on this topic. What are the benefits available to somebody who has an H-1B?
Yeah, so an H-1B visa allows you to work in the United States. It allows you to get a valid Social Security number. And it is valid for initially 3 years and then an additional 3 years, so 6 years altogether. The biggest benefit, though, is not just the ability to work and not the ability to, you know, gain experience in the United States. It's that when you know that you can be here working for a company for 6 years, you can also – you have the time, the luxury of time, to have the company sponsor you for a green card. Now, sponsoring someone for a green card is very different than an H-1B visa. The reason that it's different is an H-1B visa, first of all, is capped at 6 years. And with an H-1B visa, you don't need to prove to the U.S. government that there are no qualified and willing American workers. You just have to prove to the U.S. government that you're going to pay them the same way as an American worker. If a company wanted to sponsor someone for a green card, they actually have to go through a process called a labor certification, where they actually have to advertise the job in the newspaper of widest circulation, so the Philadelphia Inquirer for this area. They have to advertise in four other venues to be able to prove to the Department of Labor that there are no Americans to take the job. Well, that process can very often take 2 or 3 years.
Right.
So if you were to go into an employer tomorrow and say, hey, I want you to sponsor me for a green card, the employer would say, okay, how quick can you start? And you'd say, well, probably about 2 or 3 years, right? Most likely that employer's not going to hire you. But if you go in and you first get an H-1B visa and you can work for them for 6 years and they're going to want to keep you beyond 6 years, then they're more likely to then go through the sponsorship process. And that's the driving force for foreign nationals behind the H-1B visa,
and
is it's a stepping stone.
What happens if the applicant has a wife and kids?
Yeah, so the wife and kids come in with a visa called an H-4 visa. So they're allowed to live in the United States. They're allowed to be educated. In certain circumstances, the spouse is allowed to get a work permit. And then if the primary individual is sponsored for a green card, the spouse and children get the green card at the same time.
Yeah. Go ahead, Joe. I'm sorry for cutting you off.
Yeah, no, I mean, I chop it at the bit to ask this question. You know, a lot of these jobs and visas and all those things come with for jobs that, you know, you need a college education, you need specialty training, but one of the things right now during the pandemic is we're having a very difficult time hiring employees. So many businesses, that are small businesses that just can't, Americans are, you know, they're, for one reason or the other, even though the pandemic unemployment's up, these jobs are hard to fill. What can be done about that? Because I've had union workers a million times say, well, that, you know, that these people are going to take our jobs. They're not taking your jobs. Are you kidding me? That's ridiculous. But there are like restaurant jobs and stuff like that that good restaurant owners can't fill. And how do we get those people in the country legally so that they're not hiding under beds? And they can and they'll work hard and they're not going to take American jobs. They're going to help American businesses, small businesses, stay in business.
Yeah, I think the way that you do that, Joe, is that you create a new visa category. So we've talked about the H-1B visa so far, and the H-1B visa is for professionals. Well, there's another visa for unskilled labor that's called an H-2B visa. But in order to do an H-2B visa, you have to show that the work that these individuals are doing is either seasonal or temporary in nature. So, for example, a dairy job, right? Dairy farms have very, very difficult time finding anybody to work there. Let's say that a dairy wanted to sponsor someone on an H-2B visa. Is a dairy seasonal? No, not in Pennsylvania, they're not. They're working all year round. Do they have a peak load or a temporary need? No, they're busy all year round. So the H-2B visa, when that was created as part of the Immigration Act, I believe it was some point in the 90s, I think it was 96, you know, didn't envision the world that we're living in now, right? Didn't envision the economy, booming to where there's so many businesses that are able to generate income if they just have the workers. So back to your question, the U.S. government should identify certain positions that we can all agree, or at least the majority of us agree, won't be filled by U.S. citizens. Some that come to mind for me that I get calls about all the time, the number one right now is truck drivers.
Right.
Really. Truck drives, you know, if you drive a truck across country for Amazon or for any kind of goods or commodities company, you can make a very good living. The problem is that if you, you know, if you have small children or, you know, you want to coach sports, it's very difficult because you're gone for, you know, 2 weeks at a time and then you're off for 3 or 4 days and then you're gone again. Right. So lots of Americans don't want to take those jobs, even though they pay well. So there are tons of companies that would love to hire foreign nationals to come and drive trucks across the country, which, by the way, would be good for our economy, right? We would get things faster, things would end up being cheaper, and there are tons of immigrants that would come and go through the proper training in order to do that. You know, farm jobs, we talked about. Agriculture jobs have always traditionally been, heavy on immigrant labor because they just can't find it anywhere else. So to me, the idea would be, look, there's two things we're going to do as a government. Number one is we're going to try to cut down on illegal labor. We're going to put a big chunk of our budget, 20% to 30%, towards going after employers. At the same time, we're going to agree on 25 different positions that we know can't be filled by Americans, and we're going to create a way for individuals to come legally on visas to do that work. I think that would be a very good first step in fixing our immigration system and also fixing or benefiting our economy.
I find it, so you're saying to me that they don't, we don't currently have a situation, a type of a visa or a process where small businesses, which probably wouldn't be nearly as savvy, you know, you go in some of these restaurants and, you know, or a lot of different situations, it just retail stores or whatever, and, you know, the service is brutal because they don't have any workers. And these restaurants or these small businesses are probably not that savvy in regards to saying, you know what, I can't get American workers. I'm going to go sponsor a group of foreigners that want to come here and want to go to work for what we're doing. That doesn't exist already. Are you saying to me that like this would be a new process?
It would. Yeah, it doesn't exist right now. The only thing that exists, Joe, is the H-1B visa or the H-2B visa, right? Both of which have their problems, especially because there's a cap on them. Or employers that can sponsor people for a green card, but that takes 2 or 3 years.
And that's right? The other thing, timely, like, for example, I see two issues with that, number one. Number one, Sonny, as you can see, I'm rewriting immigration law as we speak right here. History's being made. Ricky just actually confirmed that. So, yep. America and small businesses, you're welcome. And having said that, it would have to be in a timely fashion, right, Ricky? In other words, you got these... You know, these small jobs, these small businesses that if we could put that situation together, I don't think we've ever had a situation like this. But then Americans would have to understand one thing, and this should be a big one. Okay, once things, you know, you feel like going back to work, you can't just throw these people out. Right. I guess there would be a time limit, I'm sure. But my point is that it's just amazing. This is a historic time right now where when you go into a restaurant, it might take forever because we just don't have the time. We don't, you know, eat, you know, like the diner that we go up the street after we do our radio shows. They have like 3 employees in there, man. It's order a chicken sandwich, you're waiting an hour.
Yep.
I mean, go ahead.
Yeah, so you're absolutely right, Joe. And the law doesn't have an emergency mechanism to deal with what we're dealing with right now,
right.
Or even a mechanism that you know is just practical that allows the government to kind of tweak it based on what our needs are. Here's another question I got all the time is when the pandemic first started, I got tons of calls from people from the Philippines and from Jamaica and from all over the place that had medical backgrounds and said, hey, look, I'll come to the United States. You know, it's my dream to come, and I have this medical background. I'll come and work in a hospital.
Right.
Isn't there a way to bring me in? And the answer is
right.
No.
Right.
And it's just kind of ridiculous that our law is so rigid,
right,
that we can't work around that. And quite frankly, you know, Joe, if you were to give your proposal tomorrow, you know, what would happen as a result of your proposal would be, it would become sensationalized. It would be, you know, the story would be on one side, yes, this could help the economy, but on the other side, it would be, well, this is going to take the job from Americans. This is a way to bring these people in, put them on a pathway to become citizens, so they're going to vote a particular way, and it's going to change the fabric of our country.
Right.
And that's why politicians, although they would agree with us, and I've sat in rooms and talked to, you know, a variety of politicians about this exact issue, and behind closed doors, they totally agree.
None
of
it
makes sense.
Yeah, no doubt about it. I mean,
get out and vote on it. Sometimes, depending on where you're from, it's political suicide. You just can't do it.
Ironically,
so, no one wants to touch this issue.
And ironically, you look at it, the business is a Republican issue, typically. You know what I mean? That's where you get it. Now, small business, you know, doesn't get nearly the respect that big business gets, but ironically, the business is a Republican issue. Obviously, working is a Democrat. This should be a bipartisan issue. And at this point, I mean, look, it can't be indefinite. But if somebody, you know, if somebody can't open their business because they cannot find employees, okay, and then there should be a way to find quality employees with time constraints or whatever. And if they, like, you know, say it's a 6 month visa, and you know that they still can't fill the job. I mean, whatever. I'm just kind of riffing here, but the point is, there's got to be a way for American small businesses to hire people, even if Americans won't take the jobs. And we can at the same time. By the way, that's a tax revenue there, right? There's a tax base.
Totally. Yeah, sure.
Yeah, I mean, so listen, let's Ricky, we're going to go to break, but shout out the name of the new law firm again, if you would, before we go to break.
Yeah, sure. It's Palladino, Isbell, and Casaza. And you can find us on the web at www.picplaw.com.
All right. We'll have more from the Payne & Wellness Hour with Sonny Banks and his guest, Ricky Palladino, after the break.
Suffering a work injury or any type of personal injury can be a painful and traumatic experience. What can make it even more difficult for a patient is trying to navigate and find the quality medical care they need for their particular injury. Healthmark Enterprises is a full-service medical coordination and marketing company started in 1994 by CEO Robin Lewison that takes all the worry and complications out of treatment for a work or personal injury. From coordinating full-service medical treatment with a top medical professionals, providers, and specialists to overseeing patient compliance and providing one-on-one personalized communications with clients. Healthmark Enterprises handles the entire treatment process for injured workers and those suffering personal injuries so they can just concentrate on getting better. Healthmark Enterprises believes that being injured should not limit one's access to great medical care. Now, more than ever, an injured person needs an advocate on their side. Contact Healthmark Enterprises at 215-563-1315. That's 215-563-1315. Healthmark Enterprises. Pinnacle Medical Plus is a full-service urine toxicology and durable medical equipment company serving patients throughout the continental United States. With over 25 years of industry experience, the professionals at Pinnacle Medical Plus provide high-quality services and products combined with excellent service at a reasonable price. On the urine toxicology side, Pinnacle is a trusted partner that provides the most up-to-date therapeutic drug monitoring technology. On the DME side, Pinnacle offers an extensive list of premium products along with priority delivery services. At Pinnacle Medical Plus, their number one goal is making sure their customers and patients receive the quality care and services they deserve. Contact Pinnacle Medical Plus for all of your urine toxicology and durable medical equipment needs at 888-396-8644 or online at www.pinnaclemedicalplus.com.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Payne & Wellness Hour with Sonny Banks. We're sponsored by Tony Sugar and Pinnacle Medical Plus. Sonny's guest is immigration attorney Ricky Palladino. We're having a fascinating conversation about immigration law, a lot of the situations, so much blown out of proportion. One of the things that people talk about constantly is that the crimes that are committed by, and the criminal records that are committed by immigrants coming into the country and all that, non-documented. Is that overstated, Ricky, and exaggerated just for political purposes, do you think?
Yeah, I don't know that it's exaggerated, Joe. I just think it's an aspect of humanity, right? I mean, there's bad immigrants, there's bad lawyers, there's bad priests, there's bad politicians. It's just a question of where you put the spotlight, right? And from my practice, having represented thousands and thousands of individuals, it's a very, very, very small minority that, have serious criminal records or are prone to violence or criminal activity. I think it's better to put the spotlight on the person that's working two or three jobs to support their family, or the person that, is able to help our economy by doing a job that requires two or three different languages in an immigrant community. So I think the problem is putting the spotlight there, but there's no doubt that there's bad immigrants. And for the most part, those individuals should be prosecuted and they should be deported. I mean, we do have laws to deport people for a reason. Not everybody deserves a chance at the American dream. And there's very, very few people, if any, that are arguing for those people, right, for the criminals. But it becomes a scare tactic, and it's a way to paint a community with very broad brush that quite frankly is unfair.
No doubt about it.
We never talked to Joe about the application time for H-1 and H-2 visas. What is that time frame?
Yeah, so for an H-1 visa, the earliest that you can apply is in April of any given year. You usually get a decision within about 3 or 4 months. And if you are approved, well, if you're selected in the lottery, which you'll know by April, and then if you're approved, which you'll know 2 or 3 months later, then the person can start on the H-1B visa in October of that year. For the H-2B visa program, again, same deal. You have to go through a lottery system. They have people coming in at two different points of the year, April and October. And it takes usually, if you're selected in the lottery, about 3 or 4 months to get through all of the paperwork and to be approved. So those particular visas, Sonny, the H-2B and the H-1B, aren't areas where we see delays. The problem with them is that there's not enough visas to meet the demand.
Right.
Where we see delays is in just about every other aspect of immigration law. So one of the things that's good about H-2A and H-2B is that the numbers are limited. So the government knows exactly how much, how many officers they need to assign to the number of applications that are coming in. If you contrast that with, how long it takes for a political asylum case right now, probably about 3 or 4 years. How long it takes to get a green card on the basis of marriage, about 1 year. How long it takes to become a U.S. citizen, they're getting better at it, but still close to 1 year. So those are the areas that we're seeing delays, in part because the government can't predict, how many people are going to apply.
And both types of visas have a 6-year limit?
So the H-2B visa is only for a very specific period of time that is either seasonal or temporary in nature.
Okay,
so very often, right, those visas are only for 6 months or 8 months, right? And then you have to reapply every year. Whereas the H-1B, the professional visa, is 3 years and then it can be renewed for 3 years.
Okay.
Ricky, how often do you actually represent somebody who wants to become an American citizen, wants to go through the whole process? How long does that typically take?
So, Joe, in order to become an American citizen, you first need to get a green card. A green card is, that's kind of the euphemism, but it means that the person is a lawful permanent resident.
Okay.
So the fastest way to get a green card and to become a citizen is through marriage to a U.S. citizen. So let me explain that. If you get married to an American citizen, it takes about a year to get the green card. And then after you've had the green card for 3 years, you can then become an American. You can then apply to become an American citizen, but then it takes a year. So all in all, you're looking at a process that takes probably somewhere between 4 and 5 years. If you're sponsored on the basis of employment, Joe, it takes probably 2 or 3 years to get the green card. Then once you get the green card, you have to have it for 5 years in order to become a citizen, to apply to become a citizen. And then that takes an additional year. So that can take 8 or 9 years. And if you're from countries that are sending high amounts of immigrants to the United States in the employment context, which is really India and China, then you're looking at wait times that are just about double, where it can take double to get the green card. So for individuals that are citizens of India or China, very often it can take 15 years to become a U.S. citizen.
I mean, that's just incredible. That must be. But when it does happen, it must be. I get emotional when I see that naturalization ceremony, and it's so moving because these people are so happy to be American citizens. It's got to bring you incredible joy and pride when something like that happens.
Oh, you're absolutely right, Joe. It's, you know, helping people become U.S. citizens is the highlight of what we do. And, you know, it's a people practice, and that's good and bad, right? It's good because, you know, over this holiday season, I would set the over under it probably 50 gifts that people will drop off. And sometimes it's a homemade dessert, or it's, you know, a tie, or
wow.
Yeah, or a Christmas ornament, right? From some part of the world. So that's the beauty of what we do. The downside is that you know we become friendly and invested in these people's lives, and you see them go through a system that's so unfair. Wow. And that takes so long that it's tolling, right? It really takes a toll. And the number one area that we see that is, you know, very often an individual who's here, their ability to travel outside the United States, if they're not a lawful permanent resident or a citizen, is very compromised. So, you know, if a loved one or a family member gets sick, people are calling us and saying, there's got to be a way that I can leave and come back. And very often the answer is no.
You mean
so
after,
that's a hard conversation to have with people.
After you're a citizen, you can't leave and come back?
No. Once you're a citizen or you have a green card, you can leave easily.
Okay.
But before that, you're going through the process, or if you're someone that's here and you just crossed the border, you know, leaving is a death sentence. You'll never be able to come back.
That's just incredible. That's why you probably have so many people that are, you know, their visas expire and they become undocumented or whatever you call it at that point. But it's definitely, you know, definitely something that is, you know, just when I think about it, it gets emotional. But like you said, you probably get very vested in the individuals during the process.
Oh yeah,
that must get personal.
It does. It does. And, you know, it's I've been lucky enough to be invited to dozens and dozens of naturalization ceremonies. The majority, they do them at the immigration building here at 41st and Market. But the local counties do them as well. And typically when the counties do them, and they do them every few months, it's open to the public. And it's, you know, I'd encourage your listeners to go and see one of them, because it really is an emotional day. And there's a lot of pride there in the United States, and they sing, you know, some of the songs that we all learned in grade school that we don't sing anymore, patriotic songs, and it's just a really nice event that I'm very glad to have been invited to many times.
How often do they have them?
So in Philadelphia, they do naturalization ceremonies probably, and I don't know the exact number, but I want to say at least twice a week. As a matter of fact, I was at the immigration building for a green card interview for a married couple earlier today, and there was a long line out front. And usually when there is a long line, it's because they're doing the ceremonies there. And in the local counties, it's like four or five times per year that they do it.
Well, that's amazing. I mean, I think I would love, how long did it last?
They last about an hour or two. It depends on how many people they have that are becoming naturalized, because, you know, each person has to take an oath to become a citizen. So that depends on that hinders on how long it's going to be.
Are they required to learn English?
Yeah, in order to become a U.S. citizen, you have to pass an English reading and writing test, and you actually have to pass a civics test. So they give you 100 questions to study. They ask you 10 questions, and you have to get 6 of the 10 correct. And if you watch like Jimmy Kimmel or Jimmy Fallon, sometimes they'll go like walk up and down the street, and they'll ask
Americans
these questions, right? It's funny that, you know, the majority of people wouldn't pass the test, the basic civics test. But yeah, Sonny, you do have to be able to read and write basic English to do so. There's some exceptions to that rule, but 95% of people to become naturalized need to do that.
I think about it, Sonny, and I just it Ricky, it must be hard in some senses to not shed a tear of joy at the smiles on these people's face. I'm getting choked up just thinking about it.
Yeah, it really is a wonderful experience.
Absolutely. Well, listen, how much time do we got, Brett? 2 minutes. Well, Ricky, we got a couple of minutes, but I'd like you to give your contact information, the name of the firm, and all that, if anybody's trying to get in touch.
Yeah, thanks so much, Joe. So it's Ricky Palladino, and the firm is called Palladino, Isbell, and Casaza. We also go by PIC, P-I-C Law, and that's where you can find us on the web. It's www.picklaw.com, and our phone number is 215-576-9000.
And Sonny, if you would, take us home.
Sure. Banks Law, 215-561-1000, and our web address is www.bankslaw.com.
I mean, you know, it's been a phenomenal show. There's so many hot button issues when it comes to immigration, but when you really hear it from one of the experts like Ricky Palladino, it gives you hope because you realize that all this scuttlebutt and all this, you know, the stereotypes and all a lot of this propaganda is not at all what things are about. Yeah, things happen in every possible way. But the fact of the matter is that we have individuals and professionals like Ricky Palladino and individuals that really care about people and people that are doing things the right way. And so on behalf, of Sonny Banks and certainly our guest, Ricky Palladino, I'm Joe Dockin. We'll shout out to Brett Cronenberger, who's our producer. I want to thank everybody for tuning in. Of course, I want to thank Tony Schuer, Pinnacle Medical Plus, for also being our sponsor and making it all happen. On behalf of everybody, I'm Joe Dockerty. Thanks for listening.